Bantam Audio Publishing presents Extreme Measures by Michael Palmer. June 7th. The sign, painted in uneven black letters on a 2-foot length of weathered barn side, read, Charity, Utah, population 381. It was pocked by bullet holes and wedged upside down between two dense juniper bushes. Marilyn Coulson would have missed the sign if she hadn't tripped over a root and fallen heavily under the hard, dusty desert ground. The discovery distracted her from the newest in a growing array of bruises and scrapes and kept her, at least momentarily, from another outburst at her husband. Their 4-year marriage was on the ropes even before they blew their vacation on this latest monument to Richard's self-centeredness. Now, as far as she was concerned, it was down for the count. The Jeep he had insisted on renting for their 4-wheel journey to nowhere and everywhere, the Jeep Richard said he could repair with his eyes closed, had broken down God only knew how many miles from nowhere. And of course, the part that had gone was the only one Richard hadn't counted on. Some psychologist. Marilyn picked several burrs from her t-shirt. When, if, for Christ's sakes, she thought, they ever made it back to L.A., she was going to call Mort Gruber and tell him to go ahead with the divorce. She glanced toward the hazy sun sinking into the horizon. Damn it, she snapped. I don't care what it takes. I'm getting the hell out of here. It's my vacation, too, and I want to eat in a French restaurant, and I want to sleep between clean sheets and take a bath in a tub with a jacuzzi. She turned and stalked up the stony slope of one of a chain of modest hills that seemed to stretch to the horizon on either side. Marilyn, will you get back down here? I tell you, we're not lost. Give or take a mile, I know exactly where we are. We can camp here tonight and then keep heading east first thing tomorrow. Marilyn! She stood motionless at the crest of the hill. Then slowly she turned back to him. Richard, she called out, maybe you'd better hike on up here. I think I may have just found Charity, Utah. The town, half a mile or so to the south, was nestled in a valley ringed on all sides by hills. It appeared to consist of an unpaved main street, starting and ending at the desert, and crossed by 2 or 3 smaller streets. To the east and north, fields of some sort stretched into the desert. "You suppose it's a ghost town?" Richard asked as they dropped down the slope and into a dry arroyo, out of sight of the low brick and clapboard buildings. "Could be, but I swear I saw lights in 2 of the windows." They followed the arid streambed for a while and then trudged up a gentle rise that ended suddenly in a small, well-planted field of corn surrounded by closely strung barbed wire. Curiouser and curiouser, Richard mused. At that moment, a bell began chiming through a series of speakers mounted on poles along the street. Almost instantly, people began emerging from several of the buildings. Marilyn stopped short. To her right, a woman stepped out onto an open porch from beneath a sign marked simply, Store. She looked to be in her late 40s, although her stoop-shouldered posture and unkempt jet hair made that only the roughest guess. She wore a short-sleeved print house dress over a pair of khaki fatigue pants. "Excuse me," Marilyn said. "My name's Marilyn Coulson. That's my husband, Richard. We're from Los Angeles. We were on a camping trip, and..." Marilyn, studying the blank expression on the woman's face, stopped in mid-sentence. "Do you understand what I'm saying?" "I understand you," the woman said. "And can you help us out? Direct us to a hotel?"
"Hotel?"
"Yes, a place to stay." Marilyn waited several seconds for a response, then turned to her husband. "Damn it, Richard, will you come over here and help me out? There's something wrong with this woman."
"She's an addict," Richard said simply.
"What? An addict? Look at those needle tracks on her arms." "Well, what should we do?"
"You can start by talking to me," a voice behind them said.
They whirled. Marilyn gasped. Standing 10 feet from them was a man. Strapped to his waist was a 2-way radio. The double-barreled shotgun cradled on his right arm was aimed at a spot just in front of them. Marilyn pushed her metal-frame bed close to Richard's. Slowly, she slid her hand up her husband's leg and began stroking him the way he liked. The day, one of the worst in a marriage full of such days, had taken a marked turn for the better. After a tense few minutes with the mental health worker, as Garrett Pike, the shotgun-toting man, called himself, they had been escorted to a low cinder-block building identified as a mental hospital. There they were turned over to Dr. James Barber, the director of the Charity Project. Barbara was a psychiatrist, a balding, cheery man with an open smile and manner. And although he had explained little of the project, beyond that it involved the reclamation of an old ghost town and was a federally funded experimental installation for dealing with the criminally insane, he had made them feel welcome. Further, he had promised assistance with their jeep as soon as his maintenance man returned from a trip to the city with the only four-wheel drive vehicle that the project owned.
"Richard," Marilyn said now.
"Yeah?
Don't you think this is sort of romantic? I mean, how many of our friends have ever done it in a mental hospital?"
Richard continued to lie on his back, hands locked behind his head, unresponsive to her touch.
"Something's wrong," he said finally.
"What are you talking about? You remember after dinner when I mentioned Stack Sullivan's theory on maturation inversion in traumatized children?"
Actually, I don't know.
"Well, I described it completely backwards."
"You what?"
"Merely for the sake of discussion, and Barbara just agreed with what I said. He's either an absurdly uninformed psychiatrist or
he probably just wasn't paying much attention to you.
God knows I wasn't. You're not exactly riveting when you get going with that psych theory shit of yours." Richard's response was cut short by a fit of coughing. He sat up on the side of his bed, hands on his knees, until it subsided.
"What's the matter?" Marilyn asked.
I don't know. I'm having a little trouble catching my breath. It's like the asthma I had as a kid.
Maybe there's some mold in here or something. Or maybe it's unexpressed stress.
I'm going out in the yard for a bit."
Marilyn lay alone in her bunk, wondering how she ever could have thought the two of them were the match for a lifetime. The last sound she heard before the darkness of sleep drifted over her was her husband's coughing. In the morning, Richard was worse, his breath rapid and shallow, his eyes lusterless. And by that time, Marilyn herself was having trouble breathing. A taciturn Navajo named John Fairweather drove them back to the road and repaired their jeep, and she got behind the wheel, determined to get them to a hospital as fast as she could. She hadn't driven a mile when the tightness in her chest intensified.
"Relax," she urged herself. An audible gurgling welling up from her chest began to accompany each breath.
Fear, unlike any she had ever known, swept away her resolve. She stopped the jeep.
"Richard, wake up," she gasped. "I can't..."
She reached over and touched his arm. His hand dropped limply to his side.
"Richard? Richard?"
She grabbed her husband by the chin and turned his face around to her. It was puffed and gentian. His eyes were open but lifeless. Thick pink froth oozed from the corners of his mouth. Marilyn undid his seatbelt. As she staggered around the jeep to the passenger door, she felt liquid percolate into her throat. She stumbled and fell heavily to her knees at the moment she pulled open the door. Richard's body toppled from the seat and landed heavily on her, pinning her to the ground. She struggled to push him aside, but her strength was gone. Soon, her will was gone as well. She slipped her arms around him and locked her thumbs in his belt loops. Over what seemed minutes, but might have been hours, she felt a strange peacefulness settle in. With that peacefulness came another feeling, a connection to Richard, a sense of closeness to him more intense than any she had ever known. And she was sure, as she felt the weight of him lessen and then vanish, that he was alive. He was alive, and he knew she was there with him. The sun had set. A chill evening wind rose from the west, sweeping a film of fine desert sand over the jeep, and the two inert figures locked an embrace on the ground beside it. February 25th, 8 months later. It was just after 2 o'clock in the morning. Outside of Warehouse 18, the East Boston docks groaned eerily beneath a crust of frozen snow. Inside, wedged in the steel rafters 30 feet above the floor, Sandy North made a delicate adjustment in the focus of his video transmitter and strained to catch the conversation below. But even if he missed part of the exchange, it was no big deal. At this distance, the souped-up Granville pickup he had brought with him to Boston could record a hiccup. For nearly 3 months, under the deepest cover, North had been working the docks for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He was, in essence, on loan to them through an agency that specialized in providing such personnel. And although his agency had no official name, it was known to those in its employ, and those who from time to time required its services, as Plan B. North had been sent in to pinpoint the source of a steady trickle of weapons from Boston to Belfast. What he had stumbled on, instead, was drugs, a shipment and sale of heroin that looked to be as big as any he had encountered. And to boot,
From what he could pull from the conversation below, one of the two men doing this...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?